Welcome to The Bridge, a weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgane, your host for the show. The Board of Clatsop County Commissioners has a new representative for District 5. The board unanimously approved the appointment of Matt Samuelson to fill the seat for the remainder of the term ending December 31st of this year. Samuelson will vacate the office at the end of the year. He did not file as a candidate for the seat in the upcoming May primary election. And financial viability and conservation goals for timber harvest in Oregon are under review for a proposed plan for counties to pool timber harvest revenue.
I believe this is the single most important issue that we've ever dealt with.
The Board of Commissioners is requesting more details about that proposal. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Matt Samuelson of ELSI is the new Clatsop County Commissioner for District 5. The Clatsop County Board of Commissioners selected Samuelson from among three applicants at yesterday's commission meeting. Commissioner Dirk Roan made the motion for Samuelson's appointment, explaining as he did so that since Samuelson had not filed for election to the position, there would be more of an even playing field for the two candidates who did file.
We have an election coming up in very short order, and we have three very qualified people, and one of them did not apply, which would be Matt Samuelson. So I feel, in all fairness to the candidates, both of which are exceptional people, that appointing someone else would allow the election to take place and allow, you know, the voters to decide who should be representing them. And I guess that's my main point, is I think the voters should ultimately decide.
Commissioner Peter Hutala seconded the motion. The commission approved the appointment in a unanimous vote. Samuelson was sworn into office following the vote by Circuit Court Judge Phil Nelson. Samuelson will serve the remainder of the term of former Commissioner Deborah Berkby, who resigned at the end of January. The term runs through the end of this year. Samuelson, a mechanic, is a lifelong and seventh-generation Clatsop County resident. He's a former member of the Jewell School District Board and is active with the 4-H and Clatsop County Fair. District 5 covers the southern portion of Clatsop County, including Cannon Beach, Arch Cape, Jewell, ELSI, and Hamlet, and portions of Seaside. The District 5 position is up for election May 20th for a four-year term beginning January 1st of 2015. The other two applicants for appointment to the vacancy, Dale Barrett of Seaside and Leanne Thompson of Cannon Beach, have both filed as candidates in the May election. Samuelson did not file as a candidate. In other business, the board approved sending a letter to Oregon State Forester Doug Decker requesting data related to a proposed change in the allocation of state forest harvest revenue to counties and local taxing districts. Under the proposal, all revenue would be pooled and distributed through a formula based on historical harvest levels. The letter includes a request for revenue projections under current formulas and the proposed pooled approach. Commissioner Dirk Roan spoke in favor of the letter.
I just want to say, in terms of the issues that the county faces, I believe this is the single most important issue that we've ever dealt with, and affects everyone in our county. And so I think it's important that we communicate clearly our concerns with the rest of the parties who seem to be willing to make decisions on our behalf that may negatively affect our county.
Commissioner Peter Hutala urged sending the letter by both USPS and electronic mail to facilitate a timely exchange of information in advance of a meeting between the Council of Forest Trust Land Counties and the Forest Trust Land Advisory Committee on April 4th. The board also approved sending a letter to the Oregon Pipeline Company regarding its request that the county, on behalf of the inactive Diking District No. 8, file an application with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to initiate the permitting process for installation of the company's proposed natural gas line across District 8 land. The county letter asks Oregon Pipeline to explain the legal basis for its request. Approval was granted for a contract with DLR Group for Architectural and Engineering Services for a planned remodel of the county parole and probation facility in Warrenton to house the Sheriff's Office Criminal and Support Division staff. And the board approved a disbursement of $5,000 to Clatsop Community Action for its project Homeless Connect, veteran stand-down, and low-income firewood programs. Also, $2,500 to court-appointed special advocates, or CASA. A week ago today, near the end of the Oregon legislative session, a swing vote by Oregon State Senator Betsy Johnson resulted in a tie that killed a bill that would have allocated unclaimed damage awards from class action lawsuits to legal aid services in Oregon. Johnson has faced criticism for her vote, which killed House Bill 4143, a bill supported by the rest of her caucus. On Saturday, Johnson was in Astoria to introduce the Stand Up Stories Speakers Forum. When she took the podium, she explained to local constituents the reason for her vote.
Legislation is never as easy as it seems. Had that bill, 4143, that is the Cypre bill, actually been about funding legal aid or not, it would have been an absolute no-brainer. It would have been on the governor's desk in a heartbeat. The bill, unfortunately, completely changed the way that Oregon would have approached class action lawsuits. At the point in time when the vote came, there were 36 amendments to a bill that was being discussed in a five-week session. I came to the notion of the short session very, very slowly. I had this sort of sepia-toned notion in my mind that when the Oregon legislature met and we were structured to meet every other year in the odd-numbered year by our Constitution, that that was a good thing. Citizen legislators coming to Salem, doing the people's work expeditiously and going home was something that was always very attractive to me rather than professional legislatures. But at the end, I was convinced that with an activist judicial and an activist executive branch that we needed the people's branch of government to be in Salem more often than every other year. And I went out and campaigned when the voters changed our Constitution in 2010 to establish the short session. I campaigned on the notion that the short session would be a minimalist session, disciplined, that we would come in and do technical corrections, we would make adjustments to current law, we would fix errors that were made in the preceding long session, we would receive the revenue forecast, we would tee up the conversation for the next long session, have hearings, talk about the big ideas that would come forward in the next long session, and then go home. Unfortunately, the short session has now metastasized into huge, huge policy debates. Another big policy item that did not make it out of the legislature was Governor Ted Wheeler, Treasurer Ted Wheeler's idea of completely restructuring the Treasury and how we do risk management inside the Treasury. Again, that bill was just way too big for a five-week session, and the bill never came to the floor for a vote. So I just offer that as an explanation. The floor speech that I made is up on my website, and I invite you all to listen to it. There still may be people that are unhappy with me, but as I said in the newspaper, and I was quoted correctly, one of the privileges of representing you is your confidence in my judgment to go to the legislature, to look at these very complicated issues, and to try to do what I think is right for Senate District 16 and certainly for the state of Oregon. And while there was, frankly, an odious defendant in this particular lawsuit, it's British Petroleum, my sense of fair play says you don't change the rules in the middle of a lawsuit. And even if the defendant is repugnant, you don't just pass special legislation to screw him.
During the floor speech Johnson referenced in her remarks, she said the bill would have done more than reallocate unclaimed damages to legal aid. It would have also made changes to existing class action laws, such as changing how class sizes are defined. Johnson said it would have been better to consider the bill during the longer session next year. Nearly a year ago, the last commercial sawmill operating in southern Oregon's Josephine County shut its doors, laying off 85 workers. Now the Rough and Ready Lumber Company is gearing up to reopen with the help of financing facilitated by the government and conservation groups. From Jefferson Public Radio in Ashland, Liam Moriarty reports.
Rough and Ready mill owners Jennifer and Link Philippi announced the reopening at Cascade Wood Products near Medford, a former and soon-to-be-again customer. They were flanked by Governor John Kitzhaber and representatives from the state and federal governments and environmental nonprofits. Link Phillippe said reopening the mill will be a godsend, not only for the newly hired workers and their families, but for the entire region.
What we are establishing today is the ability for these working members of our community to re-engage. They will stay in the area and continue to contribute as PTA members, coaches, 4-H leaders, watershed council, and church volunteers, and not to be forgotten as taxpayers.
The rural Illinois Valley, where the Rough and Ready Mill is located, has suffered high poverty and unemployment rates as the timber economy declined in recent years. A financing package of loans, investments, and tax credits totaling $5 million will allow the mill to retool to more efficiently process small-diameter logs. That's the type of timber produced by the forest thinning and restoration projects that have become more common as logging larger trees has been scaled back due to environmental concerns. Rough and Ready expects to have the new small log mill up and running by this summer. The company's conventional sawmill will remain closed at least until a legislative deal is reached that would allow more logging of mature trees from nearby federal forests. I'm Liam Moriarty reporting.
You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. I'm Kathleen Morgain. Still ahead, with the homeless population on a nationwide upward trend, a growing population includes families with children. In Tacoma, Washington, a new program seeks to help homeless kids pursue an education.
For kids who don't know where they're going to sleep at night or don't know where they're going to be the next month, the stress and anxiety that are on their shoulders, they act it out.
Taylor Winkle reports just after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Mostly cloudy, a 20% chance of rain this afternoon. Light winds becoming west, 10 miles per hour this afternoon. High temperatures today, 55 to 60. Tonight, a 90% chance of rain. Patchy fog after midnight. Overnight lows around 45. Gordon McCraw, meteorologist and director of Tillamook Emergency Management, says a weak front will result in some clouds this afternoon, followed by a chance of rain this afternoon and evening, with light rain likely tonight, continuing through tomorrow with the associated cold front, which becomes stationary, then gets pushed back up to the north as a high-pressure ridge builds back in. The models are mixed on how close a front gets to us this weekend, but most say high pressure will keep any rain off to the north until Saturday afternoon and Sunday, when another weak front brings us more rain, likely continuing into Monday. Highs continue 55 to 60 degrees, lows in the mid to upper 40s for the rest of the forecast period. Across the country, more than 1 million kids may not know where they're going to sleep tonight. It could be in a car, a friend's couch, in a homeless shelter, or even on the street. In Washington State alone, there are more than 30,000 homeless children, and for these kids, getting their homework done is the least of their problems. Now, a unique program in Tacoma is trying to help those kids do better in school, one family at a time. Taylor Winkle reports.
Tamika Gant is showing me around her cozy four-bedroom Tacoma townhouse.
Doing her homework.
Two of her daughters, Kimora and Samaya, are lying on a bed in their shared bedroom. They just got home from school and are doing math quizzes together on a tablet.
79.
Just 4 years ago, this scene was only a dream to Tamika and her husband, Bobby.
It was pretty difficult. You know, I didn't know if we were going to be homeless or whatnot, and we were just looking for other alternate routes.
The Gants had just moved to Washington State from California with their four kids. Their only possessions? A minivan and the clothes they had on their backs. Bobby was working two part-time restaurant jobs to make ends meet, but he lost them both in the same week. Now there was no money to pay rent on their small two-bedroom apartment, and it was difficult to find a new job. Bobby didn't graduate high school, and there was another complication. He has a criminal record from a drug offense as a minor.
We've been getting a lot of no's, you know, as far as no, like interviews, jobs. Oh, sorry, can't hire you because of your record.
And this is where something called the McCarver Special Housing Program enters the story. The 2.5-year-old program is a partnership between McCarver Elementary School in Tacoma and the local housing authority. It helps families like the Gants find and pay rent on a new home. The man behind it is Michael Power, and he says there's nothing else quite like it in the country.
It took us 2 years of full-time planning just to get this thing started, and we're obviously learning as we go.
Power says McCarver School serves a neighborhood that is generally low income, and poverty causes many families to move in and out of the area.
New kids come, and then they leave, and that just turns over and over and over again. So it's, for teachers, it's like trying to teach in a bus station. Every time the bus arrives, you got a whole new class.
Many of our behavioral challenges are a result of poverty and homelessness.
That's Carol Ramgremens, McCarver's school counselor. The kids call her Mrs. RG.
For kids who don't know where they're going to sleep at night or don't know where they're going to be the next month, the stress and anxiety that are on their shoulders, they act it out.
Mrs. RG says this program works by giving these kids and their families a home and stability in an unstable world. That begins with subsidizing the family's rent for 5 years. Beginning at 100%, the support decreases by 20% each subsequent year. At the end of 5 years, the subsidy stops. This was a lifeline for the Gants. Three of their kids were already at McCarver when the family lost its income, but the program was right there. Have their grades changed at all since you've been enrolled in the program?
Yeah.
Yes.
It changed big time. With this program, their grades has been above.
R or O, E or F.
On this date, their 10-year-old daughter, Samaya, and her class are working on how to spell some complicated words.
Intolerable.
Samaya says she loves reading and math and writing, but she seems especially excited about science. She says earlier today she was investigating how fast a toy car could go around various racing tracks.
So, like, when we start our investigation, we do, like, questions, and then we do a prediction in our materials, and then a procedure.
But Samaya dreams of a future of stardom. One day, she hopes to be a singer and an actress.
So, come home and...
Back at their townhome, Bobby and Tamika say without the fear of homelessness hanging over their heads, they've been able to focus on their future too. They have two more children now, and Tamika is a full-time student working towards her bachelor's degree in social work. Bobby graduated from a culinary arts program, but he put that career direction on hold when he got a full-time job at the post office.
Even though I'm doing a whole different profession, but it's an accomplishment, you know, from a person who was a high school dropout.
It gave us real confidence, like, okay, we can do this now because they're here to help us.
Right now, the housing program is assisting 42 families like the Gants and more than 70 kids. The Tacoma Housing Authority pitches in most of the funding for the program with help from Pierce County and a nonprofit called Building Changes. A measure to replicate the program was introduced in the Washington legislature this year, this time funded by the state's general fund, but it died early on in the session. The bill's sponsor says she'll try again next year. I'm Taylor Winkle in Tacoma.
Finally, air pollution is a complex mixture of chemicals and particulate matter, so complex scientists still don't know exactly what is in the air we breathe. But now they're one step closer. Researchers at Oregon State University have discovered 14 new chemical compounds. The mixtures can be hundreds of times more likely to cause mutations than other pollutants. KLCC's Jess Burns reports.
It all started here. Not in Sochi, but in Beijing, at the Summer Olympics of 2008. Concerns about the high levels of air pollution were a major storyline of the Games. That created the opportunity for OSU chemistry professor Stacy Simonich to begin doing air testing in China.
The first paper my laboratory published on the air quality and the particulate matter in Beijing before, during, after the Olympics was a little controversial.
Despite this, Simonich was able to continue work in the country, figuring out the chemical fingerprint of the air pollution and using that information a bit closer to home. Wind on Mount Bachelor near Bend. Simonich has an air monitoring station at the top where she is able to detect if air pollution in China is making its way across the Pacific Ocean to Oregon. Short answer, it is.
Some of the compounds that we found that were transported were polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons,
or PAHs. Quick science lesson. That's the name for a group of chemical compounds. Many are classified as carcinogenic and mutagenic by the Environmental Protection Agency. They've been shown to cause things like tumors and birth defects in lab mice, and a growing body of research suggests serious ill effects on humans as well, including cancer. So they're regulated by the government. PAHs are naturally occurring and happen whenever organic material is burned.
Anytime there was a forest fire or a prairie fire or even to some degree maybe volcanic eruptions, if there's carbon present, all of those, you know, for eons, since the start of the advent of fire, there's been PAHs.
Of course, since humans started burning fossil fuels like coal and oil, the amount of PAHs in the atmosphere has dramatically increased. And PAHs are even being produced at home.
On the barbecue. When meat, and in particular fat, is charred on the grill, like I'm doing right now, PAHs are produced. So I'm breathing in all kinds of PAHs right now. It smells good, but overall, not really a pleasant thought.
The greatest route of human exposure to PAHs and nitro-PAHs is diet. We tend to think a lot about particles in air, and that is important in our lungs, but the largest dose of our exposure is via diet.
Wait, does that mean I should put down my tongs right now?
No. I'm a firm believer in everything in moderation.
Through air monitoring in Oregon, Semenich found high concentrations of PAHs riding on the backs of particulate matter coming over from Asia.
And the fact that they're on very fine particles, less than 2.5 microns, means they can be stuck in the lungs once you breathe them in. And then we started to think, well, other pollutants are also transported in this mix. Could there be chemistry happening in Asia, reactions that are occurring either there or in transit across the Pacific Ocean that may be modifying them chemically?
The other pollutant is the highly reactive nitrogen dioxide, commonly found in car exhaust. With computer modeling, the scientists predicted that the nitrogen dioxide and the PAHs would combine. Then, in a lab, they recreated atmospheric conditions where both chemicals were present and tested the samples.
One sample working on it continuously could take a week or so between having the sample and extracting it, purifying it.
400 to 500 samples later, the predictions were correct. The OSU team found 14 never-before-detected compounds collectively called high molecular weight nitro-PAHs. But they didn't stop there. Back at the lab at Oregon State, they asked another question. How likely are these new compounds to cause mutations to genetic material? Using further tests, they found that the nitro-PAHs are up to 467 times more mutagenic than the original PAHs on their own. So, to give you a picture of this, imagine PAHs are tiny piranha swimming out there in the air. If you encounter enough of them, you may begin to sustain long-term damage. Now imagine some of the piranhas are carrying chainsaws. Those are the nitro-PAHs, and the combined potential for damage is much greater. But currently, those chainsaw-wielding piranhas have only been detected in the lab at Oregon State.
And so our next step now is to go into air samples from Beijing and air samples from Mount Bachelor and various different diesel exhaust and maybe even grilled meats and start to look in those different parts of the environment to see where these chemicals might be. And the truth is, no one's ever looked for them before.
That's because prior to the discovery of Semenich and her team, no one even knew they existed. I'm Jess Burns reporting.
That is all the time we have for today's show. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you joined us late, you can listen to a podcast from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the homepage. We welcome your comments. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1, that's N-E-W-S, then the numeral 1, at kmun.org. I'm Kathleen Morgane saying thank you for listening today. Listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.